The following is a special episode of Why, Philosophical Discussions of Everyday Life. What Makes a Building Beautiful? With Sarah Williams Goldhagen. This episode was recorded before a live audience in less than ideal conditions, so it's not the usual studio quality required for broadcast, but we still want to make it available to our podcast audience.
Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm sitting in Lower Manhattan, steps away from the Wall Street Charging Bull and Fearless Girl, in front of a live audience and preparing to ask Sarah William Goldhagen what makes a building beautiful. We're all on the 20th floor of the Standard Oil Building at 26 Broadway, the former address, my daughter would want me to tell you, of Alexander Hamilton, Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton, and their family. You'll all be relieved to know that I will neither rap nor sing show tunes, so American culture will survive. But we are in the New York City studio of the Cornell University College of Architecture, Art, and Planning, invited here by New York City's Citizen Housing and Planning Council. We thank both groups for their support and, of course, for the invitation. We thank all of you for being here as well. So ladies and gentlemen and everyone else, welcome to Why. Sarah Goldhagen's new book is about architecture and its interaction with human bodies. I read much of it flying from North Dakota to New York. I felt enclosed on the plane and robotic. I became totally internal, even consciously disregarding my bladder because I was trapped in the window seat. Periodically, as I flexed my ankles, I would lift the window blind to get a glimpse of the bright blue sky. Ironically, the plane, which was created for habitation, felt inhuman, while the world outside, which I could only ever experience through windows, gave me life. Yet as much as seeing the sky made me feel as if I were breathing fresh air, I only allowed myself a few moments before lowering the blind. I didn't want to disturb my neighbor, and the flight crew asked us to leave the shutters down to keep the plane cool and save fuel. The cynic in me believed, not the realist in me knows, that the flight crew uses the darkness to keep us complacent and lethargic. What's happening here? First, the designer of the plane has an ideal in mind, a docile human who doesn't move. The actual person is expected to conform to these standards, no matter how unnatural they may feel. The plane limits acceptable social interaction. We're only permitted to speak to the person next to us, but we're not allowed to accidentally touch them. We're also required to curb our internal lives. We can't be too scared, disagree with absurd procedures, or even suggest constructive changes. Plato suggested that social engineering could change human behavior. Marx argued that it could change human nature. Design has succeeded where their political philosophies have failed. Planes are also corporate in that they are designed for profit and they're collective. Passengers are not individuals. We are means to related ends, money and control. The more control of us they have, the more money they make, and the more identically they treat us, the more control they have. This also challenges human nature. It assumes that we have only one goal, getting where we're going, and that we're willing to subsume all other aims under it. I would have recognized none of this if I had not been reading Sarah's book while I was flying. It afforded me not just a vocabulary to put ideas to words, but a framework through which to notice things that I had never thought. It's not just that I learned stuff from Sarah's book and then saw her conclusions in action. It's that I understood what she told me and was thus primed to learn even more from my own experience. She turned on my architectural filter, which in turn allowed me to analyze my surroundings in a different way. What's particularly powerful about the architectural filter is that it reveals how our minds and bodies are being pushed through space. It explains why we want to walk through one door and not another, leave a table quickly, or trust a doctor. It also explains the increase in number and intensity of unruly passengers. As airline design whittles away our personal space, and as we're required to be in ever more control of ourselves, minor infractions become akin to anarchy. Resistance only happens when a person snaps, and snapping, by definition, means losing control of one's own agency. To put it another way, it is not, as we often are told, that design progresses and people reap the rewards. It's that design changes and people are forced to act accordingly to its demands. often unconsciously. Any philosopher worth his or her salt will look at this and ask, what is the relationship between design and free will? If architecture can define human limitations, where do our capabilities begin, and where do they end? In No Exit, Jean-Paul Sartre describes three people in a room who willingly allow themselves to be psychologically tortured so they can control their roommates. They can leave at any time, but they each choose not to, resigned to an eternity of suffering for no reason other than their own egoism. It's a tragic and undeniable accurate portrayal of the everyday blockheadedness of human beings. The traditional way of describing the play is hell is other people, yet the first two lines describe the furniture, not the characters, putting design front and center. Sartre tells us that we are in a drawing room in Second Empire style, and that a massive bronze ornament stands on the mantelpiece. He knows instinctively that a different room might lead to different results. A postmodern decor might motivate people to change their moral standards. A Union Steel couch may inflame their erotic imagination. None of those would take his characters where he wanted them to go. Hell may indeed be other people, but the devil needs a place to stand. The lesson of my flight to Newark is that the Sartrean phrase is incomplete. Hell is also bad design. And now our guest. Sarah Williams Goldhagen is an art historian who taught at Harvard University's Graduate School of Design for 10 years. She was the New Republic's architecture critic and is currently a contributing editor at Art in America and Architectural Record. She's also the author of two books, the most recent one released just 2 months ago. It's titled Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us online.
Thanks, Jack. It's a pleasure to be here, and I want to change the title of my book to How is Bad Design?
When the paperback comes out, I'll look for it.
Okay.
So, I guess I want to start by saying that your book wasn't what I expected. I've read architectural books before, and they're about how things are constructed and the art history that fits in, what they look like, and yours is so much more expansive. You're talking about so many different things, and so I guess the question I have to start with is this what architecture is now? Is this par for the course? What are the boundaries of this discipline that we call architecture?
Well, this is in the sense that my book is unusual within the boundaries of architecture. And most architecture books are of the character that you describe them. And that was part of what motivated me to write the book, because basically I was teaching in architecture schools, and then the New Republic asked me to be their architecture critic. I had done writing before and so on. And when I became a critic, I thought, okay, I don't want to be thumbs up, thumbs down. Like, I want to do this right. I want to really think about what makes a good building, and I want to tell my readers what it is that I'm arguing, so that they're not just looking to me to, oh, that's great, or oh, that's not so great, but to think and learn along the way. And so that led me to make a series of decisions. First, I thought, you know, buildings are public goods, and what's most important about them really is the user experience, which is something that in architecture schools people don't talk about very much, for reasons that you and I can discuss. So I would sit on these juries, and I would ask, you know, well, so what does a person feel when they're going in here? What do they see, and how are they directed, and so on and so forth? And often I didn't get, people were sort of like, we can't talk about that. Experience is too subjective. And so then I thought, maybe some of it is subjective, but maybe some of it's not. And so I set out to write a book about how people experience the built environment and how important it is to them.
You mentioned something in passing that I'm going to come back into a minute that's really important, which is that buildings are a public good. But before that, the stuff that you talk about in the book, you talk about cognitive psychology, you talk about, you have this wonderful moment where you're talking about you can predict children's behavior better by knowing what kind of room they're in than by knowing their personality. And the What the book ends up making me feel is that there is such scientific content to architecture. Yet, again, this runs counter to the notion that I have. So should I stop thinking about architecture as a science? I mean, sorry, as an art? Is it a science? Is it something completely different?
It's both, obviously. And people know it's both because you have to keep buildings standing up and so on and so forth. But I think part of the problem has been that architecture is, in schools, primarily taught as an art. And the idea that you could really talk about what people were experiencing, you could analyze what people were experiencing, you could do it better, you could do it worse, and so on, fell outside the province, or the boundaries of the architecture as art approach. So the book, I assume most have read it, is heavy on cognitive science and cognitive neuroscience and psychology. And it was totally fascinating to research this because I realized, the more and more I got into it, I realized there is a lot we know and a lot that I could put together, a sort of a paradigm of understanding how people experience built environments and the kind of impact that it has on people. And everybody needs to know this. And not many people do.
You have an interesting example about one of the other factors that influences the sort of the artistic realm of architecture. You talk about the building in the Harvard Graduate School of Design, and you talk about how they are very much in favor of collaborative work and working together, but they've constructed the building in this hierarchy of platforms, right? So the seniors are above the juniors, or the third years, right, as graduate. And that what it actually does is make them ultra-competitive. And you also say that every architecture student expects to be the next big thing, right? Everyone expects to be the breakthrough. So should we teach architecture like we often teach painting or music, and that part of your goal is to have this musical breakthrough, have this transformative creation? Or do we have to shift the discussion in a different direction? Is the goal of making the newest, best, most impressive building an obsolete notion?
Absolutely. Yes. But I think the world is coming to recognize that. The global economy supports this kind of starchitecture system where, you know, you have the same 20 architects on the short list all over the world, and they do these, they kind of helicopter these buildings in no matter where they are and so on. And everybody's realizing that is not helpful, and that architecture and the built environment more generally needs to be much more locally inflected. That being said, I would say it's not an either-or situation. Architecture is an art. It should be an art.
I want to interrupt for a second, yep. Just because what do you mean by locally inflected?
I mean that the sun falls at a certain time in a certain place in New York City, and that's different from where it falls at the same time in Sydney, Australia. And the local traditions are different, and the materials that you can have access to are different, and it's much more efficient and better for people if you use the local environment and helps to kind of really establish buildings which reinforce a sense of place, which people psychologically desperately need.
And you talk about China making one important step towards that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, China is not usually discussed in these positive terms, but I was actually really surprised when I went there for in the research for the book because, you know, it's better than people say it is, for those of you who haven't been there, and there's some things that they're doing right. Among the things that they're doing right is that they have this law that no matter how high your apartment building is, the ground floor apartments must receive 3 hours of sunlight on the shortest day of the year. Now, imagine how much better housing would be in New York if we passed that law, right? So, you know, you can do these things. You can make these spaces more humane. It's a matter of political will and information. So just quickly, architecture is an art, but I do think that part of architectural education, urban design education, landscape architects are, you know, a little bit more of this stuff, has to be this information from environmental psychology and cognitive neuroscience, and they're not getting it now.
And we'll get that information in a little bit because it's so incredibly interesting. But then I promised I'd ask about buildings being a public good. And I know that a lot of people aren't necessarily familiar with the language of public good, but what public good basically means is that it's a resource for all people to share, and that it isn't necessarily, owned is the wrong word, but one group is not necessarily prioritized above everybody else. Yet our vision of a public of a building is that it's private property, right? That a company raises capital, they hire a design, they tell them what they want, they build it, the neighbors complain that it blocks their windows or that it's ugly or what have you, and then and that's tough luck because the building is a private property. So how can something that's so private property be considered a public good?
Because it is. I mean,
you
build it.
Like a true philosopher.
You build it on your lot, and I have to live with it for the rest of my life. And then, if it's standing still, which one presumes you want it to stand more than 15 years or so, unless it's a temporary structure, then my kids have to live with it. Anybody who walks by that building is experiencing it, and it's influencing what they're thinking, how they're feeling, and so on. And so it's, yes, it's private property. That's partly the way our economy is structured. And that's fine. But architects do have a public responsibility. A lot of architects know that. I mean, one of the things I heard very early on when I was teaching in architecture school was architects are the guardian of the public realm. Sorry, developers in the audience. Against the client. And, you know, they feel that responsibility strongly. But some architects do, and there's a lot of forces pulling away at the idea that architecture and the built environment is a public good.
When you're talking about that, you actually make one of these statements that's, you know, once you hear it, is so incredibly obvious that you can't believe that you never thought of it before, but also has that incredible power of intuitive truth, which is that every single person who is involved in a building is outlasted by the building, right? Every person who designs it, every person who builds it, every person who fills out a permit, every clerk who you have to get through to get that permit, every single person is going to die before the building is gone.
Right.
And so does that mean that the... are buildings just larger than people? I mean, in that philosophical sense, but they're obviously larger than people, right? But can buildings are just community concerns then, in that sense, right?
Completely, and they always have been. But it's just that once you bring this information to bear, then you change the value that you accord to the built environment. It becomes not just private property, but becomes something that we have to really think carefully and use research so that we get it as right as we can get it at any given point. And cognitive neuroscience and cognitive psychology has really changed the way our understanding of human experience and human perception in the last 20 years. So we better look at that stuff and make sure we're getting it as right as we can now.
So you use good building and you use right building, mm-hmm. and the answer that you keep teasing us with is cognitive science, and I'm still not going to ask those questions because
okay.
I'm reeling them along. But does that suggest, and this is a leading question, does that suggest that aesthetics are no longer relevant to building, that what we are concerned about is the function, not what they look like?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the opposite. What the book shows is that aesthetics are critical to people's experience of the built environment, and the building can make you feel a different way, it can make you move a different way, it can make you socialize with people in different ways. As Jack mentioned, this wonderful study from the 1950s and 60s that you could, the psychologist did this, follow kids around, and it was called the Midwest Kansas Research Station, for an entire day he had researching, sort of chasing after, researchers chasing after one kid for the entire period of the day, and then he interviewed the kids and so on, and then he found that you could actually tell much more about the kid's behavior and conduct and affect by looking at where that kid was than you could by his individual psychology. So aesthetics really matter. I mean, if there's one takeaway from this book, it's that good design must be accorded a much higher value in our society than it is right now.
And aesthetics, as you put it, is not just beauty.
Correct.
What does that mean? What else is aesthetics other than beauty?
I'm not sure I'm going to answer that question. because beauty is a pretty naughty concept, but good aesthetics in the built environment are what I've been starting to call sticky. I mean, there are places that you imaginatively latch onto and imagine yourself interacting with. And there are certain specific ways of doing that. And there's good aesthetic design and bad aesthetic design. Here's one quick example. There's a vision scientist at the Salk Institute who's working on how people respond to what he calls collinearity. So if you think of Faye Jones's Thorn Crown Chapel, right? You look up, you have, right? And his initial findings and research, he hasn't published it yet, but he's working on it. He thinks that the reason people respond to that so strongly and so powerfully is because it actually is consonant with the way that we glance around a room in the same rhythm. So just as we now know from cognitive neuroscience that when you hear a musical piece, the neurons in your brain fire in that same pattern. Basically, what he's saying is with collinear spaces, your visual system is responding to it because it works the same way. Okay, is that aesthetics? Is it beauty? Is it not beauty? I don't know, but what I do know is that it's good design and it's important to have.
So what you're anticipating is this discussion that we're going to have in a minute about the fact that there's no clear distinction between the internal response to architecture and the external response to architecture. That the brain is going to fire in a certain way and we're going to see things in certain patterns that are themselves parallel to, reactive to architecture, and that the relationship is significantly deeper than people would have thought otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, one of the formulations I often use is that, you know, in the last 20 years, people talk a lot about the mind-body connection. Okay, mind-body connection, mind-body connection. But what this book shows, what the research that I found really shows, is that there's a missing element in the mind-body connection because we are so profoundly influenced by the environment that it doesn't make sense to talk about only the mind-body connection. It's the mind-body-environment connection. We're animals, we're humans, we territorialize spaces, we colonize them, and we interact with them all the time, even though most of the time we don't know we're doing it.
So, I was very taken by this in the book. You are really challenging a fundamental paradigm of the modern world. Right? The Cartesian model that there's the mind and that there's the body and that they meet somewhere, that Descartes thought was a binary gland, but that, you know, we use language like this. I want to be loved for my mind, not my body, or who are you really? We use this language that divides us into two, mm-hmm. and that there's a real us and an unreal us, right? The real us, and I expect if I asked everyone in this room or everyone listening, what age are you on the inside, you'd have a very, very different answer than what age you are on the outside, right? We have this self-image, and mm-hmm. so there's this sense of authentic self, this sense of this division in two, and so what you're suggesting is that this new view of architecture and the way it relates to cognitive science is challenging that fundamental view of how we look at human beings.
Totally. completely. In fact, it eradicates it. I mean, the Cartesian paradigm that the mind and body are separate has basically been made obsolete by all these findings in cognitive science, cognitive neuroscience and psychology. We are fundamentally embodied beings. We live in bodies. The fact that we live in bodies profoundly shapes how we think, what we think, how we experience the world. One of my favorite examples is for metaphors, and we'll get to it later, but for example, let's take the metaphor, I'm in a relationship. So why do you use the preposition in? Because we imagine relationships to be containers that contain us, and we're either in it or we're out of it, right? Or I'm just getting out of a relationship, right? That's, we understand the concepts of in and out because we are embodied beings that live in space. And once you start thinking this way, your head explodes because I mean, there's so many examples of how the ways that we think are just profoundly, profoundly embedded in the fact of our experience in bodies and space.
I often tease my students when I'm talking about selfishness and ethics, and I tell them that I am the center of the world, and I can prove it, and I stand there, and I spin where I am, and I say, look, everywhere I go, the world is around me, and I'm in the middle, right? And in a certain sense, that's silly, but in another sense, that's our fundamental experience, right? The universe revolves around us, and so our experience is embodied, and thus, and now we'll start to talk about the cognitive science stuff, architecture has to be embodied. And so what is this... What's the next step? Okay, so we are bodies. We are physical creatures. But how do we make the jump from, or what's the next step from this observation to an analytic principle of how we are to think about design? What does it mean to think about design in an embodied sense?
Okay, well, there's a missing link that I have to start with, which is that among the things that embodied cognitive scientists have found, people who work on this stuff, on the structure of how we think, basically, is that most of what our brains do in a day and most of what we think in a day is not conscious. I mean, and the percentage is staggering. You know, I mean, nobody can really say exactly what the percentage is, but, you know, ballpark estimates around 90%. 90% of what we think in a day is not conscious. Okay? So you think that you're making a decision or walking down a certain street because you need to go into the grocery store or I don't know, whatever, right? But you don't recognize all the things that your environment is doing to prime you to think this way or to get that idea or to go another way or so on. And so a lot of this, most of the book, in fact, is about non-conscious cognition. And then a lot of the psychological concepts come out of that.
So I'm thinking of this example, and I'm not going to get it right, so you'll have to correct me. But you're talking about peripersonal space. You're talking about the space that we can reach. You're talking about our reaction to the height of a ceiling, and you say that if the difference between a ceiling that you can reach and a ceiling that you can't reach, that you feel that difference much more than, I guess, two ceilings that you can't reach. And explain it in a more good way, please.
The example is, so we know the size of our bodies and we put our arm up, and if the ceiling is like a couple of feet above that, we understand spatially what that relationship is because we're measuring it with our body and our eyes. But if the ceiling is, let's say, okay, so I, with this, maybe I'm 8 feet or I don't know, I have no idea. So let's say 10 or 12 feet. The difference between our perception of a 12-foot ceiling and a 15-foot ceiling or a 16-foot ceiling is not that much different because it's all way taller than us. That's what that example is.
So that models what we mean by embodied, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our reaction to what we call tall... Right, is entirely about what we can reach.
Yeah.
And once it's beyond our body, it may be abstractly taller, but we don't experience it meaningfully taller.
Well, or we lose a sense of essence. I mean, walk into, you know, I experienced this most when I was looking at apartments in New York, to buy an apartment in New York, and the real estate agent would say, oh, this is your 11-foot ceilings, or these are 14-foot ceilings, or these are 15-foot ceilings. And, you know, at a certain point, I just noticed that above a certain level, that, like, it really didn't matter if it was 12 or 11 feet. It was tall, and that was good. So
let's take a more shocking example that's very personal to a lot of people, anyone who's been to school or has children. You talk about the way that two high schools of different designs have profound impact on learning and on growth. And so I ask this because we're trying to make sense of what it means for us to be talking about cognitive function, right? And so we're talking about brain, you know, cognitive science is about the brain rather than the mind. It's about the neurology, and it's about the way that the physical matter of our brain and the electricity of our brain and all those things relate to our experience. And so surely, right, the classroom is a different example of that, he says, leading again, because it's been tested over and over again, right? So tell people about the two high schools and the conclusion in the comparison.
Well, this was actually a meta-study of a bunch of different studies done in Germany, which showed that they studied kids, I think it was elementary school kids in like 10 or 12 schools, and they created a list of factors, which were basically design factors, and scored each of the schools according to, you know, use of color, private spaces where you could colonize, public spaces, noise, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they had the kids go through an entire year of education. Some of the buildings, some of the schools were terrible in design, some were great. And it turned out by the end of the year, the students in the best classrooms were almost a full year ahead academically from the students in the worst classrooms. Now, if that doesn't blow your mind and say, we got to really start thinking about design here, I mean, your kids will get better educated in better designed environments.
What are the characteristics of a good classroom as opposed to a bad classroom?
Acoustics are very important and often neglected. Textures are critical because, this is another study, this was done with college students, but they found that if you put college students in a room that has linoleum floors, you know, just kind of like a typical room, linoleum floors, fluorescent lights, and seat them in a circle, or you take that same room and you put rugs and task lamps and soft furniture arranged in the same way, more students will participate, they'll learn more, and they'll test better by the end of the year. So there are a lot of factors that go into it. You know, it depends on what kind of class, what age you're doing. Color is something that I think that architects, I mean, they're not trained really to think about it a lot, and there's a sort of truth to materials ethos in architecture, but, you know, there's one organization in New York City that goes in and just paints really bright artists. She's an artist. It's called Public Color, and paints murals on public school walls. And guess what? The retention rate is higher. Students don't drop out. They come more frequently in all of these schools. She's got a lot of data about it.
So, I mean, this is so, it's not like texture, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's something that a lot of us take for granted. I mean, we like things we like, and we don't like things we don't like, but the idea that texture can have such a strong cognitive impact, I mean, obviously it works in partnership with other things, but it's, I don't know, it's almost unbelievable. So I guess I want to ask you, to sort of push that point, what's happening in the brain and how does it relate to the architecture that something like texture is going to have such an impact?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me that question. This is one of my favorite parts of the book, which is, I mean, which links back to peripersonal space, which is, so I did a lot on the visual system, and cognitive scientists have basically found, they used to think you had the vision system, you had the auditory system, you had taste, you had so on, and then your brain kind of puts it all together. Not how it works at all. So if I'm looking at a highly textured surface, let's say, like a knobby rug or something like that, I'm not only using my visual system to understand that, I'm also using my motor system because I'm imagining touching it as I look at it. Motor neurons fire when you look at highly textured surfaces. If you focus on the door handle over there, my motor neurons will fire because I sort of imagine, you know, grasping onto that door handle in certain spaces. Then it becomes, to go back to your thing, part of our peripersonal space. Like my personal space is what this is, right? But my peripersonal space is what I can imagine I can interact with and engage with.
This also leads to, it's a little bit different part of the book, but I think there's a connection here between the fact that we actually think of human beings as placing themselves in space in a very different way than they actually do, right? We think in terms of grids, right? Returning, because we have an architecturally minded audience here, returning to Frank Lloyd Wright. Mm-hmm. The Frank Lloyd Wright represents a completely different, first he anticipated and then turns out to be true, understanding of exactly how we put ourselves in space. I am not thinking of myself in a square right now. Is that correct?
Okay, so what Jack's referring to is that people won the Nobel, cognitive neuroscientists won the Nobel Prize last year, the year before last, because they finally figured out how the brain does spatial navigation. And it turns out, it's actually really interesting, in orthogonal rooms like this, wherever you navigate yourself spatially, or even imagine yourself navigating spatially, what you're doing is you're taking your body as one point, picking two other points in space, and triangulating. And then as you keep walking through space, you do that. So in the book, I compare a Walter Gropius plan, like, with what Frank Lloyd Wright did, which also has to do with the cone of vision, in which Frank Lloyd Wright basically, at a certain point, used hexagons in almost all of his architecture. Because that is, hexagons are made of triangles, and it basically is more consonant with the way that we navigate through space to have diagonal views than to have orthogonal views. That also has to do with the cone of vision, of course, what you can see out of the corner of your eye. But this idea that what we're doing in navigating through space is creating triangles within hexagons, which is exactly the way that Wright designed for a lot of time.
Right, you quote his son as saying that when my father was working, he was seeing things out of the corner of his eye.
Correct.
Right. So, but when I think about mass construction, when I think about the houses that we build and the buildings, they're not only just squares, but the pieces are squares, right? I mean, the sidewalks are in squares, and then when you see them shipped, the walls are squares, and things are component parts, and they fit together. So, I mean, isn't the world of construction entirely rectangular?
Well, it certainly has been, and, you know, for obvious reasons, which is that you need to make modular parts, it's easier, the measurements are regular, and so on. But that is changing a bit, because the digital technologies are now sophisticated enough where you can, you know, you can sort of do, or you're beginning to be able to do, the architectural analog of mass customization, where you can make more complex surfaces, and so on, as inexpensively as you used to be able to mass produce these really repetitive orthogonal units or rectangular units. Now, that being said, you can certainly do things. I mean, there are also, I talked about collinearity. I mean, there's also plenty of good things about right-angled spaces too. That's one of the complexities that I had in writing the book, is that I wasn't, when the brain is something that has 2 billion neurons and 3 trillion connections out of those 2 billion neurons, I mean, it's just staggeringly complex. You know, I wasn't writing a design handbook, because some things that do one thing are not doing something else, but something else is doing other things. So anyway, you can take an orthogonal space, and for example, I look right there out of the corner of my eye. This is a right-angled space, but it gives me a diagonal path.
So we're starting to redefine the notion of beautiful and the question of what makes a building beautiful, because part of what you're saying is that for a building to be beautiful, it has to represent how we actually see. And so any building that isn't consonant with that sort of triangulation, even if it meets certain aesthetic principles, is not going to be beautiful because it's not going to interact, I'll use the word, elegantly with human beings. Is that right?
Or wayfinding could be a problem.
Okay.
There are very famous buildings out there that where people just can't find their way. And the Seattle Public Library is one of the most famous examples, by Rep Kohlhaas. I suppose you could call it beauty, because, you know, people in general like to feel better than worse. They like to feel like they like to feel that they're anchored in space, they understand where they're going, and that doesn't mean that architecture has to be safe. Not at all. Because they also like to be engaged. That's why they want sticky spaces, because they want spaces they'll remember and come back to, and then they'll change, and so on and so forth.
Let's talk about the best intentions gone wrong for a second, because I want to talk about the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin, because
mm-hmm.
it's a really striking example of what it means to be contextual. You spent a lot of time in your book talking about how you mentioned earlier the sunlight in areas, but you also talk about how buildings have to be representative of landscape and the way the wind blows, but also cultural norms and
mm-hmm.
cultural practices. And so you have something incredibly important like the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin. What was it supposed to look like, and what happened when it looked like they wanted it to look like?
The idea behind the people know what the Holocaust Memorial looks like. It's basically,
I think most people won't.
Yeah. Okay. It's basically sort of a sea of pylons or slabs, and they get bigger, they get smaller, and at the same time, it's very, very large. And at the same time that the slabs are going up and then going down in these kind of beautiful rhythms when you look at it from up above, the ground plane is sinking down until you get into the center of the space, just very subtly, and then moving back up. And the architect's desire was to create the sense of oppressiveness and kind of feeling trapped.
And they're in lines, right? The
right.
Very, very rigid.
They're all
ordered.
On a grid.
Right.
Thank you.
And if you look at it from above, it looks like a zipper or something like that, something with very predictable lines.
Yes.
That you know, you're being walked in a line towards a very unpleasant place.
And it certainly looks, for aerial views, it looks like a very unpleasant space to be
terrifying.
In.
Terrifying.
right. But when you're there, it's a very different experience. Because he placed all of those slabs on grids, you always have sight lines out. You never feel oppressed. You think, oh, that's cool. There's that person way down there. I wonder what they're doing and which way they're going to walk versus which way I'm going to walk. And the slabs toward the edges, the boundaries of the Holocaust Memorial, actually get so small that people sit and picnic on them and stuff. So it's actually a very warm, kind of inviting place to go. And then there's, you know, there's a little bit of, wow, I'm standing among all of these slabs, but you never feel this sense of trapped oppression that the architect insisted was the core of the design.
So, and in the book, you have these two contrasting pictures, the one of the Holocaust Memorial up above that's terrifying, and then this great picture of, you know, kids in colorful clothes jumping from slab to slab. Ooh, the Holocaust, it's fun, you know. let's go throw the beach ball, right? And so it's not that from on paper and from an ideal and from a certain vantage point, it's not aesthetically success. It's that once it's placed, once it's contextualized, once bodies are in it, then it fails completely.
Yeah, well, I think so.
I suppose people can differ.
I've had people writing in the case say they had a different experience there, but that was certainly mine.
And you actually say in the book, right, you say, and this is one of my favorite lines, experience is idiosyncratic, cognition is not.
Correct.
Right? And so, sure, we're going to have experiences of buildings that are different, and sure, we're going to have feelings that are different, but what you're really talking about is how human beings engage rationally, how we think, how our brain works prior to the experience of it, because so much of it is precognitive, pre-experiential, mm-hmm. That it happens without us knowing.
Mm-hmm. Say that again. I'm sorry.
Sure, no problem. What you're talking about, the reason why you're talking about cognition as opposed to experience and the
right.
shift, right? The shift, because we're no longer talking about aesthetics as how I experience it as a thinking being, and does it give me a glimpse of the sublime or something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Right.
But we're talking about the rational structures of human beings.
Mm-hmm. Well, not rational, because a lot of it is not rational.
Right.
A lot of it is associative and quite illogical, actually. I mean, non-conscious cognition, behavioral economics is a perfect example. Well, we know that people are not very logical in a lot of the ways that they think. We are talking about the structures of the things around us working with the ways that we actually think or not.
So let's move away from the critical lens and
mm-hmm.
think proactively. You end the book with a couple chapters on recommendations for design for the future.
Right.
What does, actually, I'll ask the question, I'm going to say something beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
What does the successful design of the future and embodied architecture look like? And the question I'm going to ask for, again, once again, the leading question is, surely this is going to be too expensive to do.
No.
Right?
Absolutely not. No. You can make it. It costs just as much money most of the time to do a bad building as it does to do a good building. And all you need in order to do a good building, not all you need a lot of things in order to do a good building, but one of them is knowledge about how people actually experience the spaces that you're building for them. And that's part of the reason that I insist on shifting the conversation from experience, which most people, when you say, you know, how do people I used to say when I was working on the book, I'm writing a book about how people experience built environments, and everybody would go, really? Like, you know, what can you say about that? It's so subjective. But cognition is not subjective. Cognition is what we do with our brains, and that's how we have experiences. So we can talk about a lot of this stuff. In terms of, you know, I don't give a design program agenda, but I do, one of the things I talk about in kind of just giving orienting things for people to think about is part of the reason that most of people's experience of the built environment is non-conscious is because the built environment is mostly static, right? And we habituate to static things. They're always there and don't move, and we're much more interested in people anyway, and we're really much more interested in ourselves than any of us. And so that staticness is one of the things that the architect has to overcome. And there are all sorts of ways you can do that. One, you can use natural light, which changes all day long, even if you can't get views. You can put nature into it, if that's possible. Nature changes, and so on. You can use water elements. You can construct a building such that other people, your experience of other people, is constantly shifting, and your experience of yourself as a body in space vis-a-vis other people is something that you're made aware of. I mean, Kuhlhaus's early architecture is actually brilliant at that. At sort of, there's one moment where you're standing in a gallery in the Kunsthal in Rotterdam, and all of a sudden you hear noise above you, and you look up and you see the ceiling is a grate. And there's this guy, and you're looking at his feet standing on top of your head, because the floor and the ceiling, one man's ceiling is another man's floor. It's just this open grate. So you look at this body in foreshortened perspective above you. It's a very uncanny moment. And you know, you can construct moments like that where you suddenly go, wow, I'm a body in space. That guy's a body in space. He looks really weird. You know, things like that.
So, and you talk about using greenery and mm-hmm. topography and texture.
Right.
And in a couple minutes, we're going to bring two other people up, and we're going to have more of a conversation and involve in the audience, and we'll probably talk a little bit about public policy.
Mm-hmm.
But in anticipation of that, at the very end of the book, you connect to my domain, political philosophy, and talk about two people who actually we've had, both of them, on Y, Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum. And you talk about what they call the capabilities approach. And what you argue, and I wonder if you talk a little bit about this, that what architecture, what design does, is actually increase human capabilities.
Correct.
Why that is. And when you start a little bit by talking about what you talk about in the beginning of the book about slums and shanty towns, and that incredible image that you have of the homes constructed in Haiti. Talk a little bit about that, about what deprivation does, and then we'll switch the conversation, talk about what good design does, and then we'll invite Mark and Majura.
So one of the things I often say is there's no such thing as a neutral building or space. If it's not helping you, or helping students learn, or helping people get better, it's probably doing bad things, okay? And so they're hindering students from learning and so on. And so what we need to think about the built environment as an opportunity to enhance cognitive development, well-being. The built environment clearly helps people heal. We know that from a lot of studies in the healthcare industry. And use it in these ways.
So Haiti, talk about Haiti.
Oh, Haiti. I couldn't get that image out of my mind. There's an image in the book of a series of shacks in the middle of a highway on a divider after the hurricane there. And I just thought, you know, those people are going to be damaged for the rest of their lives because they have to live like that. Because those kids have to live like that. And there is a ton of evidence that that's the case. It's scandalous that anybody has to live in those kinds of circumstances. They will be disadvantaged for life because of it.
And this is one of the reasons why, and I'll give you what I think is a very good compliment, that I think the book is ultimately a philosophy book. Because we often say, people have to live like that. But then when you ask, what does it mean to live like that, quote unquote, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And people don't necessarily have an answer because sometimes it's intuitive, sometimes it's complicated, sometimes it involves disciplines we don't know anything about. And we can talk about, oh, how awful it is that they don't have this or that. But what you're doing in the book is you're really articulating what that is.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have access, not just running water and things like that, they're obvious. They don't have access to green, they don't have access to sight lines, they don't have access to differences in contours, right, and textures, right? That the houses are made of plastic,
yeah.
The noise.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's brutal. It's It actually shares certain, I think, lines in the photo with the scary photo of the Holocaust Memorial. Because there's similar, right, that grid-like regularity and, yeah, and that sense of trappedness. So we know then that living like that impairs people's capabilities, that they're just, like we saw with the school, they're not going to have that same learning ability, they're not going to be as happy, they're not going to be as healthy. How does design increase our capabilities and help us make that transition from the sort of the theoretical point to the public policy conversation that I suspect we're just about to have? What is the connection between design and the capabilities approach?
We know that good design, people feel calmer, they learn better, they physically suffer fewer ailments, their minds become engaged in good design, and they become more aware of themselves as bodies in space, and more active, more aware of the agency they have or don't have in these kinds of spaces. So it's critical. It's as critical as any one of these other things that Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum talk about as enhancing human capabilities.
I really would urge people, both in the room and listening on the radio and in the podcast, to read the book. It's tremendously accessible. It's well written. It has wonderful photographs. And Sarah takes us on a journey that, at least for me, who is at best an architectural amateur, and I'm being very kind to myself, really reveals something about the world and about our intellectual structure that was completely beyond me. And it really is going to change people's perspective of just how we look at our bodies in space. Mm-hmm. Philosophers, phenomenologists have for most of the 20th century, struggled with what it means to be a body in space, but it's very abstract. And this is not, right? There's a lot of deep stuff in here. There's stuff about our internal senses and how we regulate our body and stuff that I could never do justice to. But the book itself is just a tremendous invitation to seeing a world that is both right in front of our eyes and that we're completely oblivious to.
Thank you.
So this has been a wonderful conversation. I was so looking forward to this and waiting on tenterhooks for the book to come out. You know that. But there is another aspect of it, right? We're here with the Citizens Housing and Planning Council, the oldest advocacy organization for good and affordable housing in New York. And there are people here who are very activist oriented. I have I know there's some Y Radio fans in the audience and some old students of mine who have dedicated their life to representing people who need representation. And so with that in mind, I'd like to invite two people up to further the conversation and to also to open it up to the audience and see what the more theoretical conversation leads to public policy. So first, Mark Ginsburg is an award-winning architect and partner at Curtis & Ginsburg Architects, LLP. His expertise is in affordable and mixed-income housing, resiliency, and green design. He's also the president of the board of the Citizens Housing and Planning Council. And Richard Roberts is director of business development, Redstone Equity Partners, and former commissioner of the New York City Department of Housing Preservation and Development. He is the chair of the board of the Citizens Housing and Planning Council, and neither of them have ever met me or knew I existed before today, so I really appreciate them being good sports. Richard and Mark, thank you so much for joining us online.
Thank you very much.
So I guess I'd like to start by asking the two of you a question. We are so used to power politics and special interest politics, and certainly as being a housing commissioner in New York City, that's got to be a high-pressure thing. To what extent do your vision of design and do your sense of yourselves as having architectural opinions, to what extent do those sorts of things influence your attitudes about what good housing is, affordable housing is, and the policy suggestions that you make during your whenever you get the chance?
Yeah.
This is Richard. I'll take a stab at that. I would say a couple of things about that. Personally, very little. When I had the job, I was there are so many, and I think this is kind of part and parcel of the discussion. There are so many things and considerations that you think are important or you're told are important that you tend to prioritize those above things like design. Now, that being said, I think that one benefit that, and Mark can probably speak to this, one benefit that that we have had in New York City in terms of the creation of the amount of public of affordable housing that we have over the course of the last...
Actually, Richard, I apologize for just a second, but since we're quick, could you move just a little away from the microphone? It's a very powerful microphone, and it's echoing, and people are having a hard time hearing it.
Oh, push the microphone.
And the stuff that you're already saying is really important, so
okay.
I don't think you can miss it.
So, it's my first time on a podcast. anything like
we'll get you a T-shirt.
Okay, yeah.
Actually, we have mugs, not T-shirts.
Okay,
but we'll get you one of those.
I'll take a mug. we really have benefited from the fact that design has always been kind of a component of what the city's housing agencies have focused on, and I will say for better or for worse. We have two housing agencies in New York City, one the New York City Housing Authority and Housing Preservation and Development. Housing Preservation and Development has historically been more of a development agency. After the massive public housing developments were developed in New York, the Housing Authority is principally a management agency. Design in the creation of public housing had historically been kind of almost punitive. People were penalized for living in public housing. We really didn't want to create it. We really didn't want people in it. We didn't want people to stay in it. As bad as it looks from the outside, and you mentioned this in the book, from living in East Harlem, which has the highest per capita amount of public housing in the city.
Yeah.
As bad as it looks on the inside, outside, if you go inside, the effect that you, Jack, you mentioned earlier, which is that when you get off elevators in public housing, you can touch the ceilings as you walk down the corridor. That's how low the ceilings are when you get off the when you get off the elevator. So you can imagine how that feels. In the creation,
let me interrupt for just a second to connect with what we're talking about. So, because our physical space makes us feel trapped, it's not a very big jump to think that we are trapped in life, right? That the physical space of being trapped is going to define the fundamental way that we see our body in the world outside of the building, too.
That's true. That's very true. But the creator of that housing also has a different, a corollary, a message that they want to give you, which is they want you to have the feeling of wanting to get out of it, you know, as quickly as possible, which is, you know, if you don't have the means, it's kind of a, it becomes even a more difficult situation.
So the actual purpose is different than the stated purpose. The stated purpose is to care for these people and to give them opportunities they don't have, and the actual purpose is to make this a flow-through system and get them out as quickly as possible.
That was the theory behind, I think there are a lot of complicated theories behind the creation of public housing, and so I won't go that far, but I will say that there are many mixed messages, is what I'll say. In the affordable housing that we've created and that we've sponsored in New York, we've been much more intentional about the design. That's been a much more positive experience. But I would say where Sarah's book kind of is very helpful is that it gives us a different objective for design. As opposed to designing around equity, the idea that we want to give people basically the same thing, because we don't want to pick winners and losers in the design of our affordable housing. We want people to be kind of on equal footing with people who own homes. So we want to kind of sort of replicate what home ownership might look like, and we certainly want to as much as we can within cost. The cost parameters, not disadvantage people who are living in affordable rental housing versus someone who maybe has more means and more resources and can afford housing in the public market, in the private market. So, but these are not the objectives that, you know, that we've just, that you all have just spent a fair amount of time talking about, which I think are very important.
I want to ask a question that the audience has posed, because it dovetails a little bit what you said. You were talking about equity, and one of the central lessons that I impart my students over and over again, one of the central lessons of political philosophy is that treating people equally does not mean treating people identically, right? That in order to afford people the same opportunity, you have to allow for different things. And yet there is this question, and this goes back, I think, to Sarah's comment, and maybe Sarah can also comment on this, about cognitive experience not being idiosyncratic. We have 9 votes in the audience for this. How do you account for cultural differences in the way people experience space? Public housing in New York is going to have 50, 60 different people of cultural backgrounds and different desires and different goals, and some people will be new Americans and some people will have been in poverty for several generations. And so how does all of this, I guess Sarah first and then Mark and Richard, how does all of this take account of cultural differences? Is it misleading to suggest that, well, we have a one-person-fits-all solution?
Well, anybody who knows my previous work knows that I recognize cultural difference. I recognize gender difference. I recognize historical differences. I got it. I got all that stuff. But what I became interested in is what's not different. And people are so busy talking about all these different identities and identity shaping that nobody's talking about the rest of this stuff, which is, who knows how big a part of it, but it's a big part.
I'd like to just...
this is Mark.
Right, sorry.
The first time I hear your voice. Now that they know your voices, we don't have to acknowledge you by name ever again.
I think, and this is something I think about a fair amount, a lot of the Tower in the Park Housing Authority developments that Richard's talking about is punishing people. The people who envisioned it thought it was going to be a great breakthrough. And so one of the things that I think about, because I have some people who are mentors, and some of the buildings are getting torn down, and they, in at least one case, are not alive. And when it was built, it won awards from the AIA, and there was a lot of thinking, and it wasn't just design. There was a theory book in the 70s called The Sensible Space by Oscar Newman, and some of those theories were implemented in buildings, and everyone thought this was going to make buildings encourage safety, and they didn't work. And I've been in Tower in the Park buildings where in the apartment you're looking out, it has great light because there's a lot of space, and if it's done right, there's a green space, and so they're not all horrible, and they have sometimes worked well. A lot of it relates to things like maintenance. Do they plant the trees and mow the grass and keep the grass? The other thing I just wanted to address just a second is my main function in life is, I guess, as a practicing architect. So much of our profession is dealing with meeting, there are a lot of different requirements and rules and regulations. So minimum room sizes, maximum room sizes, accessibility codes, energy codes, life safety, all of which I'm not knocking are important, that the amount of time when you're in architecture school and all you're thinking about is design, the amount of time you're able to think about design, and we try very hard to think about something in each project that's designed as new, is different, is often hard. And one other thing I'd add that we spend time doing, and I push in the office, is, and actually HPD requires it, are furniture plans. Because people will design apartments and the furniture won't lay out well. And if you do a furniture plan with typical furniture, doesn't mean people are going to set up their apartment that way. They have a choice of how to do it. But at least, you know, something reasonable might fit into it. Okay. And I think, you know, if something as mundane as that becomes very important.
Let me pose a very specific question. Grand Forks, North Dakota is a refugee resettlement area. And so we have a very significant Somali population, Bhutanese population. There was an incident quite a few years back where some Somalis had slaughtered a goat in the parking lot of where they were living. And I didn't know this family personally, but I'm sure knowing having had the Somali students that I've had and having friends, what they say is, we have to do it somewhere, right? And so how does something like that, a ritual that is very culturally specific, but that requires a very specific space, how does that fit into this discussion, right? Because I think this is part of what the audience is getting at in terms of cultural difference, right? Do you ignore those kind of local cultural differences and say, well, you know what, you're just not allowed to slaughter a goat, or does the cognitive change that good design make have an impact on what people will not want to do and how they want to do it? It's not the most articulate formation of the question, but I want to push this cultural relativism question again because it's so incredibly important.
I don't know how you accommodate a variety of different things, but I mean, one example I would cite is that, you know, when I was housing commissioner, we had a very good, difficult time responding to the needs of the Orthodox and Hasidic communities in Williamsburg and Brooklyn, where the requirements of, you know, two sinks and a variety of different, you know, elements of the design that were necessary in order to accommodate the religious and cultural requirements were just very difficult for us to incorporate into our, into our design guidelines. And it was a very contentious issue with the community. And their view was, you're financing affordable housing for whom? You know, we certainly need it. What is it, you know, why can't you, I mean, we're not making this up. You know, we're not making these requirements up. Why can't you be responsive? I mean, why can't you build terraces so that we can, you know, well, you know, we don't do terraces in affordable housing. So this becomes these things become difficult to accommodate, and I think the sensitivities associated around them are real. But
so again, a question in the audience: is the inability to do this a factor of cost? Is it simply that good housing and flexible housing is expensive, or is it a product of the fact that you are thinking in large groups and different people?
Yeah.
And to what extent is it a one size fits all?
I think cost is often what is. I agree with Sarah's earlier comment. I mean, cost is often, particularly from a policy standpoint, is what is paraded out as the impediment. I think the bigger issue is the to parse through that, it would be expensive to do. It's expensive to accommodate. The perception is it's expensive to accommodate everyone's difference. You know, that would get to be expensive. If I do it for you, then I've got to do it for others, and then that will ultimately get me into a slippery slope of unquantifiable expense. And I think that's where the concern comes.
Ginny, I just want to say something about Mark's comment, because I totally get that there are building codes and zoning codes and fire codes and all sorts of things, and that, I mean, I've had this question again and again, designers sort of looking at me plaintively and saying, you know, I don't have that much control. And that's precisely why I wrote this book, not only for architects, because it's a bigger problem and more people need to pay attention, and you guys need more latitude. So, anyway.
And there is an emerging field and a lot of discussion, a lot of smart people who are very focused on the intersection between housing and health, as an example.
Right.
And that is becoming a serious set of considerations, not just for housers, but for healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
And that is how you start to move the needle on these types of, when you have broader groups of folks talking about
it. Consideration not there for housing.
Well, Siri is talking to you.
Siri may have an answer.
Siri may have an answer.
How do we solve the housing problem?
Exactly. But that is a... you know, is when you have a broader groups of professionals and people who are concerned about these issues, reading books like this, coming together, and talking about these issues and their intersection, I think that's important.
Well, I'd also, what Sarah's talking about, it can also be really helpful. It isn't taught, from my experience, much in architecture school, but that
Sarah's making a big zero to the audience.
I very seldom interact with the end users, the people who are going to be in the apartments. Because when we're designing the apartment, we're working with public agencies, developers. No one knows, because what happens is when the building gets built, there's a lottery done, typically for affordable housing. So you don't know, and I've had a few exceptions, and you don't get called back unless there's a real problem. So we're often quite disconnected from the people who are using it to understand, to address issues like Richard talked about, which I know. And if there are common elements that we can learn about that work for everyone, that would hopefully allow us to do something better.
I push back on that a little bit, just because I think that there is that is true with respect to the end users of a particular building. But ultimately what happens is that when these design elements go through a long process of kind of feedback, and when they're not designed right or when they don't work for people, elected officials hear about it. HPD hears about it. That then gets informed into the process on a going forward basis. It's not as in real time as when private individuals and either commission buildings or commission an apartment or have the ability in the marketplace to vote yes or no on on a particular product. It's something that Hovnanian or somebody like that is building for you. You can vote with your feet and decide whether or not the design works for you. But there is a process of informing. It takes longer. It's less direct, but there is a process of informing what the end product ultimately is, I think, over time.
I was just going to say something else that our goal, I don't know how often we meet it, is if you're designing something that's an affordable housing and it's next door to something that's market rate, you can't tell the difference. And sometimes we succeed, and in part that means we're doing something right.
Okay, great. So let me ask then another audience question, because it ties in directly. And especially since in the monologue I mentioned the question of free will. If you can't tell the difference between, say, a market rate and an affordable housing, if it's done right, to what extent does economics and to what extent does the environment determine the options? Don't you think economics policy and et cetera determine the environment? And that's how the question is phrased. But let me adjust it just slightly to ask, to what extent do both the limitations or the beneficial apartments or housing that exist anywhere really stack the deck in the beginning for what happens? Do people have the ability, when it comes to design, to overcome their circumstances, to pull themselves up by the bootstrap, or is design so powerful and housing circumstance so powerful that it really is ultimately a losing battle?
Well, it's so funny. just kind of thinking about the book and listening to the conversation, I mean, there are yes and no. I mean, I think that, we would all prefer to start in the same place and to have the same opportunities. There obviously are people who, who have overcome and it's much harder. And I think that has implications looking on a macro basis on how, how groups of people have fared. I would think that, black kids like my parents who grew up in the Jim Crow South and lived in the conditions in which they lived before they migrated north, I would say that the odds of them being successful were much lower than they are for, people like my kids who I think have a lot of advantages, and in particular in terms of the environments in which they live, in which they go to school. So I don't know that it's a fait accompli. It obviously has a big impact. I would say that the big issue that you have, to follow up on Mark's point with respect to the hopefully affordable housing being indistinguishable from, or largely indistinguishable from, market rate housing that we do in particular neighborhoods, is just the availability of it, right? I mean, it's just, there are just much more options and opportunities for people who are, who have the ability to secure housing in the private market relative to people who are operating in the subsidized market. I mean, it just, you know, that's one big difference.
So, I hope it makes a difference, since that's what I'm doing.
I was going to say, we couldn't be sitting here.
But I would add that one of the things, and it isn't my area of expertise, but there are studies that show that economically mixed neighborhoods, the kids in lower income families do better. That's something I can't control. It has the financial policy. And so hopefully design helps, and I believe it does, but there are a lot of other issues tied in there.
And that brings up the last question I want to ask, and then I'll say a few things before we go. We went so quickly away from the design questions in Sarah's books. Right? It became, once we started talking policy, we were talking money and politics, and people are talking about enviable things that they've tried to do, and the audience responded to these things, right? We go so quickly from the foundational conversations to the policy conversations and leave the foundational questions behind. And so I guess the question that I want to end with, and for all three of you, and let's, for symmetry's sake, let's go from Grisha to Sarah. Is it possible to have a meaningful public policy conversation about foundational issues like the kind of thing that Sarah is talking about? Can we have a meaningful, powerful conversation that involves policymakers, that involves fundraisers, that involves special interest groups? Can we have a real American-style political environment and still have the kind of conversations that Sarah wants us to have?
I believe so, because I think that what Sarah's doing is bringing a lot of the data and information to the fore. It's impossible for people, I think, at the policy level, in the political realm, in the bureaucratic world where these services get delivered, to have these conversations if they don't understand the basis on which Sarah is making the points that she's making. But I think as this information and as this contributes to the dialogue. Absolutely, because we've brought other things. I mean, listen, once we started to focus on, it's not a hoax, right? Once we started to focus on sustainability and climate change and got that information out and resiliency, right, that started to get incorporated into design and the buildings that we built. And I think the same thing is possible here.
I'd agree, and I'd also add that most of our clients really care about what their buildings look like, how they operate, how energy efficient they are, but also do believe that if they take care and we take care and think about these things, we may not know enough to think about all the things right, that it's going to make it a better building and a better place for people to live. And people think about that. So I think that is... that there is a real opportunity for the discussion.
Great. I mean, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because I thought, some of the studies that I used came out of the healthcare industry, which I think is doing some really interesting research. And basically, I was looking at a whole bunch of different disciplines to kind of create a paradigm to shift the way we think about design. But, if you think about the design of the built environment in the way that people currently think about public health, right? Then you have a different paradigm, and these sorts of conversations become obvious.
We've taken a tremendous journey in this conversation. Right? We started from
I guess we started from the 20th floor of the Standard Oil Building in downtown Manhattan. We've gone through Haiti. We've gone through Finland. We've done all of these things, and we've also gone from the deepest philosophical questions to some of the hardest public policy questions. And this is the tension of all of these kinds of conversations. This is the tension. How do you include everybody, but how do you focus on sameness? How do you talk about experience, but also focus on the cognitive functions? How do you look at people as individuals, and how do you look at people as a collective? That's a tremendously hard process. And I think if I were to wrap up and say anything, it's that we spent a lot of time talking about how design is embodied, and we followed that thread to see where it went. But we also have to recognize that our conversation is embodied, that we are who we are, and we talk the way we talk because of our physical experience. I am, you can't see it on the radio, but I am looking at people while they're talking. I'm looking at the audience. The audience is looking at us. People are leaning forward when they're interested. They're leaning backward when they're not, right? Our analyses are embodied. We're not going to ask questions that don't interest us, right? Other people might have different interests, but we're not going to ask things that don't speak to our physical experience as well as our intellectual experience because, for lack of a more sophisticated way of saying this, our feelings are physical as well as imaginative. We haven't really talked that much about the role of the imagination. Sarah does, and the way the role it plays in sight, in comfort, and things like that. But our analyses are embodied, and our inquiry is embodied. Analysis and inquiry are not the same thing, right? Analysis is looking at something you're already interested in and trying to identify how it works, trying to discover new things. But inquiry is about what we choose to ask about in the first place. Inquiry is about what we are going to spend our time, our resources, our attention, our identity on in order to find those answers. And the power of Sarah's book for me is that it opened up a brand new realm of inquiry. It opened up a lifetime of questions that I know are going to follow me, not just because they're of intellectual interest, but because they speak to my everyday experience, whether it's on a plane from North Dakota or in a panel discussion in downtown Manhattan or on the back deck in Grand Forks, North Dakota. It is about my experience and how I look at the world, and I'm already redecorating in my head and doing all these things. These are the questions that interest us. And the power of Sarah's book is that it puts that forward in an undeniable way. You may end up not being interested in the book, you're entitled, but you cannot tell us that these are not incredibly important questions and the discussion of the future. You've been listening to Mark Ginsberg, Richard Roberts, and Sarah Williams-Goldhagen on Why, Philosophical Discussion About Everyday Life. I'm Jack Russell Weinstein. Thank you for listening, and as always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.